This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inspired Minds.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Inspired Minds. I'm Helen Sini and I'm your host today because the man who's normally behind the microphone, Brendan O'Shea, is in fact this week's guest. Now, there's a reason for that. This, unfortunately, is the last edition of the programme, so we're paying tribute to Brendan, who's been the inspired mind behind it. Now, the programme went to air for the first time in 2002, and since then, Brendan has profiled around 500 artists, including some of the biggest names in the fields of music, art, literature and performance. So, Brendan, let's go back to the beginning. What was your inspiration for the programme?
Well, I think the inspiration from the programme at the beginning must have been a chance to create a platform where these wonderful artists got to give more than 5 minute interviews. And by organising it in the way we did at that time, of course, this was the very early days of internet, we decided we'd try and tie this up with internet and make it then, of course, both a radio and an online broadcast, which, of course, it has become, and it's become a podcast as well.
Well, Inspired Minds has been a very ambitious undertaking. Just how difficult or easy has it been to get hold of these icons of the arts world for interviews?
No, well, that's an easy one to answer. Difficult. Sometimes it meant waiting around to all hours of the morning to talk to a particular singer when she'd finished signing her autographs and talking to the various people. Sometimes it meant writing, you know, in the case of Stockhausen, I think it took us 18 months for him to agree to give me a 20-minute interview. And, you know, eventually when you got there, it wasn't a problem. But getting to these people was often very, very difficult. That's true.
It's also probably difficult to generalise, but are the really big names the ones who have made the biggest impression on you?
The very funny thing about this is that the bigger the name, often the more down-to-earth these people were. I remember, for example, the rock star Sting, basically just sitting there and having a chat to him and, getting through my interview, getting to the end of it, and him turning around and saying to me, "Now, come on, let's have a chat about you. Tell me about you. What are you up to?" All the rest of it. I think also for me, one of the really, really big moments of my career as an interviewer was to meet Dame Joan Sutherland, because I think you would understand this. Joan Sutherland is an absolute legend in Australia. And I remember ringing and very cautiously asking if I could have this interview. And then, yes, Dame Joan will talk to you and all the rest of it. And then thinking, oh, my goodness me, there she is. And walking over and speaking to her and saying, you know, "Dame Joan, my name's Brendan O'Shea, I'm Australian and I'm supposed to interview." She says, "Oh, yes, let's just sit down here." And she says, "Now, what about a cup of tea?" Said, "Dame Joan, can I get it for you?" And she said, "Oh, well, that would be very nice."
Okay, so let's drop a few more names. Who else have you enjoyed meeting and talking to?
There have been so many. I think one of the most special moments for me was an author who's not terribly famous called Lee Stringer, who wrote a wonderful book called Grand Central Station, New York. His story was so remarkable because he'd actually been a drug addict, and he came into the studio and he told me how this relationship he'd had with a pencil had become more than just an implement for drugs, but actually he worked out that you could write with it, and he started to write, and just how he actually, passed through an amazing phase in his life. I think we could have a listen to a clip there.
It was just a pencil, you know, it wasn't an obvious drug implement. But one day, as I'm living underneath Grand Central, and I have no money and no drugs and no energy, I pull it out and say, you know, and suddenly discover that, yeah, and it's also a pencil. You can also write with this thing. And more to kill time than anything else, I started out describing a friend's apartment. And I kept writing and developed into a story about someone who's dying. And my friend actually was dying. And a few remarkable things happened. First of all of a sudden it's 5 hours later and I haven't thought of getting high. It's a remarkable thing. People check in to rehabs to get this, and here this simple pencil did it. Second thing that was remarkable is that when I read the story and I think about my friend, all of a sudden I'm in touch with his pain. you know, with who he is, which is another remarkable thing, because the whole idea of getting high is to anesthetize all that. I mean, you got to imagine the phenomenon of this simple act having these results. It just blew me away.
I mean, a lot of the people that you've talked to give interviews all the time. It must be pretty difficult coming up with original questions so that their answers aren't too predictable.
That's a very good question, actually, because it is very difficult. You know yourself, if you're interviewing people all the time, to be authentic is incredibly difficult. But what helped a great deal was the name of this program, Being Inspired Minds, actually appealed to a lot of people because, you know, inspiration is an interesting thing to talk about. And the journey to the questions, often I might have had a notebook full of questions, but most of the time I ended up not looking at many of those because we'd start to talk about inspiration. And just about every artist in the world has a very unique connection with his inspiration, how it happens. I mean, some people, of course, can say, well, you know, I had this particular vision, or I saw this particular scene, I saw this particular person, and that sort of prompted an idea or started an idea in me, which turned into this book and turned into this, that, and the other thing. And then, of course, some people had a very practical. There was one particular author I remember. I said to him, you know, so your inspiration, where's it come from? And he said, well, my inspiration is the sound of my chair being pulled up to the desk. And he's, of course, meaning that he didn't believe in any of this rubbish. He just was a hardworking writer and he sat at his desk and wrote every day. So that was always very interesting. People would talk for a long time about that. And the process was always very, very personal and very, yeah, very unique with every single person.
But, I mean, let's face it, the word diva is often associated with the arts world. I mean, I know you're not going to tell me which stars are high maintenance, unfortunately. Is it a bit scary interviewing people who do have a reputation for being difficult?
Yes, it is. And I remember right at the very beginning, for example, one particular American diva who I had actually experienced in a rehearsal earlier on, and I actually heard her going for the orchestra saying that if you don't play more quietly, I'm going to walk off in the middle of this concert and there's going to be a scandal. And I remember not sleeping for two nights before this particular interview, but actually getting there. And that interview took place at about 1:30 in the morning, of course, when she'd finished signing her autographs. And her sitting down to have a chat then wasn't a problem at all. And actually, at the end of it, she was supposed to go off and, you know, have a special glass of champagne with various dignitaries and turning to me and saying, yeah, what are you doing now? We could maybe go and have a drink. The other thing about divas is, of course, that, you know, most of these people, most of these artists have made it to the top of their professions and they're under a lot of pressure all the time to perform and to perform at their absolute best. And so I do have a lot of sympathy for the sort of stress, the difficulties that they face in their lives. And so I think often when you sit down to talk to a diva and you signal to them that you understand and appreciate their profession, then, you know, these people have climbed a long way. It's a long way to fall. And I can understand them being slightly cautious about, people like myself, journalists.
I mean, you've interviewed people from all sorts of different fields. I mean, that obviously means that you have to do an awful lot of research beforehand.
A lot of research, of course, in the case of authors who are always very, very interesting people to talk to. It meant reading a lot of books. In the case of musicians, listening to lots of recordings, in particular new recordings or different recordings that they've done. Yes, there's no way around that. But the fact of the matter is then when you do sit down to talk to these people, something happens. And I always thought it was more important for me to be listening to what they said rather than thinking about the next question. And I think that's, you know, often questions and are born out of answers. And it's quite sad if that doesn't happen that way. Somehow, if you've got an agenda to get through, then you'll sometimes miss the most interesting aspects of people. I think it's just careful listening.
I mean, you're a musician and writer yourself. How have these interviews and encounters impacted your own work and style?
Well, I think as a musician, I met Pierre Boulez, Karlheinz Stockhausen and Maurizio Kagel. They're three names that just come to mind at the moment that actually were guests on the program. Kagel gave one of his last interviews ever to me. And of course, I've played the music, I'd known the music of these people for my entire life, and then to actually sit there and meet them, then it did have a remarkable impact on me to be able to go back and understand perhaps a lot of what they're after. I think possibly one of the people who certainly impressed me the most was Anita Lasker-Wallfisch. She was the cellist in the women's orchestra in Auschwitz. I had met several Holocaust survivors before, but I'd never actually sat down to talk to somebody about this. And this is, of course, what Anita Lasker-Wallfisch had been doing for the last decade, talking to people about this. And I just remember her words about her relationship to music. And it was quite difficult to understand all of these other things, this horrific thing that had happened to her in her life. And for her to also have this remarkably pure and genuine relationship to music. When you see somebody survive something as horrific as that and then still come through and have a very, very genuine relationship to their art, that can't do anything but impress you.
You see, music for me is something which is so utterly untouchable. I'm actually quite frequently asked, how is it possible that you can still, after all that, play the cello or that you can listen to music, etc.? Well, don't think that the Germans were able to kill music. They killed millions of people. They destroyed a whole civilization. But music? They can't destroy that. So for me, music is all something to escape to, you know, to be on a untouchable plane. I think that is the importance of music to me.
I mean, has there been a moment when someone has said something which has really struck home, but also changed the way that you think about your life and your career?
Well, Pulitzer Prize author Frank McCourt, I had the great pleasure of meeting him when he was about 68, 69, also shortly before he died. He actually wrote his big Angela's Ashes when he finished work because he said, you know, there was no time for him in his life. He basically spent 40 years of his life recovering from his childhood and then sat down to write and actually discovered that what somebody had said to him 40 years before, that he was a bit of a literary genius, turned out to be quite true. And the impact that this person made on my life, the whole fact that these people have survived such amazing adversity to actually then turn it into something as wonderful as a great book and work through in that way, I found that really touching.
Just finally, Brendan, you've interviewed hundreds of people for Inspired Minds, but who would you still like to meet and talk to and why?
Oh, there's lots of those. I always thought I'd like to meet Bob Dylan, Toni Morrison, Leonard Cohen, many of them. But if I look at this in another way, I've always thought if there was somebody in history I would have liked to have interviewed, it would have been Joseph Haydn. Now, the reason for that is because, first of all, I've always adored his music. But when you find out more and more about Haydn, Haydn was this, you know, court musician and he worked very hard. In his music, you find the most amazing sense of humour. It's just hilarious. And I could imagine that this guy must have been such fun. I would have gladly have gone, done an interview with him and then gone off to the pub with him because I'm sure it was going to be a laugh for the night.
Brendan, unfortunately, that brings us to the end of what's been a unique and also entertaining programme over the years. Our thanks to you for that. And of course, it's only fair that you have the final word to your listeners.
Indeed. And thank you very much, Helen, for today. I'd, of course, firstly, I'd like to thank all my guests over the years. Close to 500 fascinating people were so generous with their time and to share their inspirations with me. Not to forget all those terrific studio technicians who sit behind the glass. And as many of our listeners might not be aware, without their support, these shows wouldn't happen. And last and certainly not least, you, dear listeners, for being such faithful followers of this series. And from me, Brendan O'Shea, for the last time, it's goodbye from the studios of Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.